This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
Oh, it's so good to see all of you. Thanks for being here today to share this story with me. I'm not sure how my talk was advertised. I forgot to look at the website. I think it might have said that I was going to talk about killing and stealing, and I'm going to talk about that. But I kind of came up with a better title that kind of holds up the material together in a way I liked. And the title I came up with is The Non-Duality of the Precepts. So, are there people here that consider themselves pretty new? Maybe this is the first time they're here, or a good number of you. So I think I probably should define duality and non-duality, and maybe I should talk about the precepts a little bit, introduction-wise. So what is duality? What is non-duality? Some of you probably have some nice, sexy definitions of it. I don't know how sexy my definition is, but I think of a duality is making things separate that aren't separate, at least the way the Buddha sees the world, the reality of the world is that everything is interconnected and all actions influence all other actions. But we like to split things apart and turn things into good and bad, and black and white, and light and dark, and all these things are dualities. And we tend to think of these things as very separate from each other, even though the reality is that they're so deeply intertwined that there's no separating them really. Evil deeds don't happen in a vacuum. Criminals and victims are victims themselves. So we have this deeply interpenetration going on in reality. We have everything, what we call dependent co-arising, where everything is dependent on everything else, and we try to simplify it. Does anybody have a definition of duality that they like a lot that is kind of snappy? Okay. Well, we'll do with what I've said so far. I hope it makes sense. I think everybody kind of knows what I'm talking about when I say duality. We get a little bit addicted to duality because duality is simple and it makes us feel safe and secure when we can name the bad guy and we can name the good guy, the guilty one and the not guilty one. So that's what our criminal justice system has to find out who's guilty. I don't know that there's a solution to that, but that's what they have to do, and they always want to do it as fast as they can so that people will feel safe and secure once the guilty one is put away. I recently saw a movie that I just loved because I thought it was so non-dual. It was on Netflix, Baby Reindeer. Anybody see it? Yeah. It was such a beautiful non-dual story. We had a stalker, and a stalker's so-called victim. They were the main characters. But they were both portrayed in such an incredibly real way that you could see the incredible pain they both suffered and the need that they had. The man who was stalked was desperate for recognition, desperate to be seen, desperate to be admired, and the stalker, of course, admired him, so they just danced around each other for a long time before he even reported to the police that she was a stalker. And he led her on in all kinds of very ways. I mean, he even had sex with her. I mean, you know, he just, you know, he needed her, she needed him. They were very real, and it was an incredibly, I just thought it was one of the most wonderful portrayals I've seen of, non-dual characters. Okay, so duality. So what are the precepts for people that are just recently new? In our Soto Zen practice, we have 16 precepts. There's six of them that are pretty all-encompassing. The first six of them are practiced, I believe, by pretty much all Buddhists. The first three are the refuges, where we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and vows go along with those, that we vow to realize the Buddha of in us, the wholeness that we are a part of. We vow to honor the Dharma, which is a variability in life and all the things that interact with each other, and we vow to learn from those, and we vow to create harmony in our Sangha, in our congregation. And in fact, we vow to make harmony with all beings. So those are the first three, and the second three are that we vow to do no evil, we vow to do all good, and we vow to save all beings. Yeah, nothing to it, right? Anyway, so those are the big overreaching precepts. But then then we get down more into the grass, into the dirt, into the details, and we. In Soto Zen, we have 10 what we call grave precepts, which can sound a little bit like the Ten Commandments. They have to do with, killing and stealing, and being greedy, misusing sexuality, lying, inebriating ourselves and others, you know, all that stuff. We grow up thinking we're not supposed to do those things. I mean, we aren't supposed to do those things, but you know, somehow. It's interesting. I didn't really know this, but the 10 grave precepts that we practice in this Soto Zen and all of Soto Zen were actually compiled by Dogen, and they're based on the Brahmanet Sutra. The Brahmanet Sutra is the one that gives us Indra's net. And if you don't know what Indra's net is, it is a profound description of the interconnectedness of all of us, because Indra's net is the universe is Indra's net, and every intersection in the net is a jewel, and all of these jewels reflect all of the other jewels in the net. So that even if a little black ink spot appears on one of those jewels, then all of the jewels would have that little spot on them. That's how interconnected we are. So these precepts can sound, and sometimes they're stated in ways that really sound, like I said, like the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not misuse sexuality. But in Zen, the precepts aren't really thought of as being strictly rules developed by human beings in order to manage our social interactions, but rather they're an embodiment of the reality that the Buddha saw after he sat for 6 years, day and night, and awoke to the reality of all this incredible interconnectedness that we're a part of. So it seems like if these precepts are supposed to be about oneness, because it seems a little paradoxical that they get so often treated in such a dualistic manner, as if we're being morally given a moral injunction not to do these things. But in truth, they are practiced in a quite different way. So my talk is based on this book, which is a new book written in 22, Opening to Oneness. So there's that word oneness, the non-dualism, total interconnectedness of us and all. This is by Nancy Mujo Baker. She was a Zen scholar and a priest in the lineage of Azumi Roshi. Her teacher was Bernie Glassman. Bernie Glassman is famous, I think, at least I always think of the expression bearing witness when I hear him, of him. Bearing witness is his word for being able to see see clearly and be able to face the sadness of the world and the seamy side. He's led workshops in concentration camps in Germany and in prisons and in the street. He leads retreats for homeless people, where people like us go out and act as if we are homeless and live like we're homeless for a couple of days, so we can really feel that that misery, that kind of misery, and face it, learn to face it. I'm digressing a little bit, but anyway, Mujo Baker's book, Opening to Oneness, is this book just really, really resonated with me. We have a lot of good books about the precepts. We have, I forget her first name, but Rosetto, I don't remember the name of it, something about seeing who you are, and we have Waking Up to Who You Are, thank you. Yes, the librarian. Waking Up to Who You Are, which is a wonderful book. And we also have, of course, why is his name escaping me?
Reb Anderson.
What?
Reb Anderson.
Well, Reb Anderson, yeah. He, being upright, I think it's about the precepts for the most part, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking of the guy from the Diamond Suit.
Robert Aiken.
Yeah, Aiken Roshi, right. The field, Mind of Clover. So we have a lot of great books about the precepts, and this is a new one, but it is a little different, slightly, to me, a little more emphasis on the fact that working with the precepts is learning to see how we don't live up to the precepts, and that is very important to see. Instead of aspiring to keep the precepts, we look deeply into our failures to do that. She's got a lot of exercises. She's got exercises in the book, mostly after each precept. Maybe you might work on it with yourself or in pairs, and you would say, how have I stolen today? Or how have I killed today? And so on, through all of the 10 precepts. So she digs right down. She helps us learn to dig right down into the nooks and the crannies of our thought. She goes past just the conventional ways that we steal and kill into how we steal and kill in our thinking mind every day. And it's very expanding to read her ideas about this. She does mention the way we, it's very easy. I don't know about you, but when I was introduced to the precepts, I thought, sure, I've misused sexuality, and certainly intoxicants is a problem, but I don't kill, I don't steal, that's not me. That's okay, those are easy, I don't do those things. Well, she's here to tell you we do those things. And it's important to see how we do them. So, you know, she talks about the actions we do that are literally stealing and killing, things like, grabbing a parking place. Say you're coming along and parking place opens up on your right and you zoom in, even though you're very aware that there's a car sitting there waiting. You steal this parking place from this other person. Or I imagine many of us have stolen from our companies. You know, we spend an hour making copies on their copier for our personal use, you know, and those kind of things. All, you know, maybe most of us don't are aware of those kind of things, and that is stealing. But some people don't think of it as stealing, or they think things like, "Oh, I work really hard for this company. I probably don't get paid enough, and they owe this to me." You know, wrong. It's stealing. That guy, he's probably stolen parking places too, so, you know, he'll understand. Most of our concern is that we don't get caught doing these things, not so much facing the fact that we actually are stealing. Did I miss anything I wanted to say? But beyond that, so she goes deeper. She goes deeper, like I said. She goes into, how do we steal and how do we kill in our own minds? I wanted to talk about her names for why. Actually, they're Dogen's names for the precepts. Sometimes the precepts are presented as thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, or just maybe not killing, not stealing. Dogen presents them as non-stealing and not killing because he's trying to keep them from being, this is the non-duality approach to the precepts. That if you're in the realm of the wholeness, of the oneness, there is no such thing as there's no separation. And if there's no separation, there is no stealing and there is no killing. If we introduce into that the idea of not killing, then we have actually introduced separation into it. So sticking with the word non allows us to step back. You know, we've got killing, non-killing over here, two dualistic ideas. You step far enough back from it, they turn into one thing. And in that realm of wholeness, there is non-killing. It doesn't even exist as a concept. So, speaking of all the precepts, is non-killing, non-stealing, so forth and so on, is a way to emphasize the non-duality So let's look at non-killing. Muto Baker presents it the way Dogen does as non-killing. Diane Rosetto calls this supporting life. That's what she calls this, because non-killing is supporting life. Another lineage that I looked at called it recognizing that I am not separate from all that is. So you can start to see how, you know, where she's going with recognizing I am not separate. So we kill this oneness, we kill this beautiful interconnectedness when we separate it from it. And how many thousands of times a day do we separate ourselves from other people? I figure I'm probably about 99% of the time in a separate place. Painful place to be, isn't it? Being separate. Sometimes we don't see how painful it is. So anytime we create separation with others than ourselves, we're killing. If we practice ill will, we're thinking bad about other people, we're putting some kind of big barrier between ourselves and somebody else, we're killing. We're killing that relationship that we have, that we could have with that person. If we're wishing harm to another, killing. Doing hurtful criticism, blaming, we're killing. Another way we kill is we kill our spirit, our own spirit. And also, I didn't mention, we separate from ourselves. We don't want to see the bad parts in ourselves, so we're killing those. Let's kill those and be happy with what a wonderful person we are. And we're killing it. We kill our spirit, and we kill the spirit of others by just negative thinking or feeling. I mean, thoughts come up, I can't do this, I'm no good. Killing our spirit. A lot of times we can't help it. It's based on the conditioning of our lives. But it's important to see what we're doing, even if we feel like we can't do anything about it. Just like the guy in the main character in Baby Reindeer couldn't. He needed to be adored. He couldn't not fire up this relationship. But it's important to see what we're doing. That's the start. That's how we start. We just see what we're doing, and we face it completely in all of its ugliness. So we kill our own experience. Well, I already said that. We kill it by smothering parts of us that we don't want to think about. And we're self-conscious. Consciousness is a killing. You can see that. I'm very self-conscious, so I see all the time how that kills my relationships with others because I'm so self-conscious. I started doing her little exercise at the end of the day of asking myself, how did I kill today, or how did I steal? And the other day it hit me that I was with a friend who's helping me out in a caregiving situation, and I really, really like this woman. But this particular day, I don't know, she had a chip on her shoulder. Maybe something happened to her. I don't know. But I could not get past the hour we spent together. I could not get past the feeling that she doesn't like me. She's angry with me. I've done something wrong. And I got so obsessed with thinking this that I really didn't pay much attention to her. And I realized later that was killing. I was killing this relationship, this chance to be with her, because my big fat self got so much in the way, you know. And I was so obsessed. Oh, she doesn't like me. It's all about me. So we kill. That's our main way of killing, is just being so obsessed with ourselves. And But Mujo Baker also did have a little, I thought that was kind of humorous. She talked about the positive aspects of killing. She talked about how Zen masters kill our delusions. Killing delusions, okay, that's good. That's good killing, not bad killing, okay? She said that we kill self-consciousness. Some people kill self-consciousness, but with humor, you know, like that. And we use words like, that joke was a real killer, you know? Well, I don't know, maybe that meant that I was so self-conscious, and then I started laughing at your joke, and I completely forgot myself. You killed my self-consciousness. Wonderful. So, along with asking yourself, how did I kill today? Other questions to ask yourself to investigate your relationship with killing is, how attuned am I to my own feelings of separation? Do I realize when I'm separating? And how am I holding on to myself when I kill? Because once we understand what we're holding on to, how we hold on to ourselves, how we value ourselves, what we treasure in ourselves, the story that we tell about ourselves, how tightly we hold on to that, once we can see that a little bit more clearly, then it will sort of start to let go of us, instead of us needing to let go of it. So if we can actually see our self the way we really tell lies about ourselves. I mean, I'm not talking about the lying precept, but we tell lies about ourselves to ourselves. And the more we hold on to these lies, or the more that we see that we're holding on to them, the more they will let go of us. I like the idea of them letting go of us. It's like, oh, I just have to see it. And this is a 24-hour-a-day job, not just sitting on a cushion, but during our whole day. So stealing, what is stealing? Stealing, non-stealing precept. I think one way that one is stated is being satisfied with what I have. Because, you know, that's what makes an enlightened person. An enlightened person is a person who is satisfied, and is content. So to steal, we need to feel separate, and we need to have a sense of lack. And so some of her examples of stealing are using too much water during a drought, feeling like the earth is ours, and we can do anything we want. We can take as much water as we need. We can turn our air conditioner down to 72 so we'll be comfortable and use up a lot of fossil fuels to make our big long drive to Montana, because that's what we want to do. It'd be fun. Leaving a mess. I mean, these are things I've never thought of as stealing, but leaving a mess for someone else to clean up, we're stealing their time. Stealing, and again, leaving a mess, stealing enjoyment from others. So now they get to look at this mess instead of a beautiful landscape, throwing things out of the garbage. I don't think most of us do that anymore, but I remember back in the 50s when we did throw things out of the car. I don't know why. I don't know what we thought was going to happen, but we threw things out of the car, and we're ruining, you know, we're making a messy landscape, stealing enjoyment from other people. Here's a good one, stealing joy from another person, maybe because we can't tolerate their happiness. Maybe we feel a little jealous, so we change the subject when they start to talk about something that they're really happy about. We change the subject because we don't want to face their happiness. It makes us feel too uncomfortable. Or even on the other side, we steal from other people's truth when we can't bear to face their misery, when we can't bear to face their sadness. We're stealing. We can't bear witness, so we're stealing, again, a relationship with them. She mentioned something that's a little far-fetched. She talks about grave robbing. She says, we steal from the past. We steal from the past, which then the result that has is we're not really here for the present. It reminded me of a guy I knew once that had a very lovely girlfriend 10 years before, didn't appreciate her, ended up dumping her, and then spent the next 2 years being incredibly remorseful at this one relationship that he had destroyed. And how sad, stealing from himself that he was not living a full life. I guess we all do that, we hold grudges, and again, we're getting into stealing from our relationships with other people and killing those people in the process. So Lou Jo's came up with it. She thought it'd be a good bumper sticker. She said, have a past, but don't let it have you. I thought that was kind of nice. Other ways we steal is we want enlightenment, but we want it for ourselves. We don't want other people. We want to be a little bit more enlightened than the other people. We're stealing. Here's a big one, needing to be the center of attention, stealing attention away from everyone else, bringing it to yourself. So that's about all I have to say. I don't know what you think, but I really love this way of practicing. I think it's just another way of getting to know ourselves. I mean, there's many ways to do it, but doing it through the filter of the precepts is I think a really great practice, and I just wanted to talk about that. I have another little story I wanted to tell about my own life recently, because I think it brings a lot of this whole thinking about dualities. I have a friend who is not aging very well, and I'm kind of one of his caregivers. And recently, last summer, another caregiver and I got him situated in a nice apartment. But a couple months later, a mentally ill person moved in next door. And I guess that's kind of now renters are required to rent to anybody that can afford and it doesn't have a criminal record, and so these kind of things happen. And this woman was incredibly difficult. She screamed all the time. She had a lot of other people that would come and visit in her apartment, and they would stay up all night many times, probably doing drugs, staying up all night, making an incredible amount of noise. She would even be out in the courtyard screaming. She didn't just talk, she screamed. Very, very, very difficult person. And my friend was having a terrible time. He was in hell. He couldn't sleep. And I was, I and the other caregiver wrote letters to the owners, and this situation can't exist. This is not right. She was evicted. It took a long time, like 3 months, I think is about what it usually takes. She was evicted in a rather cruel way. All her stuff was removed, and they put plywood up on her door, and and we thought, oh, it's over. The problem is over. Well, it was over for me, my friend. It was not over for the woman. The next day, she appeared at the complex with all of her stuff, and she sat out in front of the complex in a chair, and it looked like probably she was homeless, you know. And it made me so sad. I just felt so bad about it. After, I guess the police came and visited several times her, and then finally the next day she was gone. And I noticed how relieved I felt, because I didn't have to see this anymore. I didn't have to see this dead woman. It was, for me, it was over. I kind of killed the whole situation. It was done. But, you know, of course it wasn't. And I felt like that. I am no different from those politicians that want to put homeless people in prison or push them out into the country or lock them up somewhere, put them in, you know. I am no different from those people, because I don't want to see it. That's my story. Anyway. So we have time for any comments or questions or great.
I guess as you were giving your talk, I had like two separate thoughts, and they're kind of interrelated, having to do with the precepts, and it helped me think about what I actually think about the precepts and how we live it in our lives, enmeshed in the world. I guess the first thought, and it was really driven home by your story, but also like the example of like, you know, people who steal from their boss that overworks them or something like that, and that like what we do is part of a bigger system. And if we, like, what does it mean to behave ethically or by the precepts in a system that many people see as being pretty fundamentally unethical in deep structural ways that kind of...
Like war.
Or even like buying cheap goods that were made by someone who didn't have very many options and had to work exploitatively long hours in some other part of the world. And it's like baked into everything that we do. And what does it mean when we hold ourselves up to say that we're engaging in the precepts or something like that? And the other side, I guess the flip side of that was, I know that you felt really bad about how this woman got evicted in this process that was kind of degrading and destroying the quality of life of your friend. And I guess my two thoughts about that are, one, that yeah, like it's not your fault that you're part of a bigger system that doesn't take care of this person, but also like, how do precepts interact with the idea of having boundaries or personal boundaries? Because it seems, in my experience, not having any boundaries creates its own set of dynamics and creates suffering in the world if you don't have boundaries. And it's better to give people, boundaries can be a gift that you can give to other people.
Yeah,
that was very, very, very. So those were my two, like, thoughts that I just wanted to kind of put out there. See if you have any thoughts.
No, I mean, those questions are, those things are just sort of overwhelming, aren't they? We have soldiers who are taught to kill, and, you know, are they following precepts? Wow. And I don't for 1 minute regret that the woman got moved, because that was a terrible, you know, an unlivable situation for not just my friend, but anyone else in that complex. But I don't have any answers. I'm really sorry. Except to say, you know, we just have to see what we're, you know, what we're thinking. And, yeah.
Well, my mind also went to boundaries. When I read Waking Up to What You Do, one of the things that stuck with me the most about stealing was stealing lessons from people. Because I consider myself
stealing lessons.
Lessons, life lessons.
Oh, less stealing lessons from other people. Oh,
yes, like, because I work with teenagers and I have a 6-year-old and I'm kind of like in a helping profession. You know, my son will sometimes just like take his clothes off as soon as he enters the house and just like shoe fling over there, shoe fling over there. And like, I like a very tidy house. So I'm very tempted to just go pick it up and
stealing his opportunity to learn.
Yes, I'm stealing his opportunity. Yeah. I'm stealing from my future self. I'm, you know, that shielding him from consequences isn't helping him or anybody. Mm-hmm. And so the precept about stealing, I was kind of surprised at how much it helped me develop boundaries for myself.
Mm. Excellent. Thank you.
So, killing. I think if we stand out there and we see somebody about to run into somebody else with a knife, we would probably try to stop this person.
Mm-hmm.
But your conversation about killing is so much deeper, right? So where do we step in as practitioners when there's killing that's going to be happening unto ourselves or unto somebody else in a not so obvious manner? Made me think, you know, speaking of movies, last night I was watching Separate But Equal, which Brown versus Board of Education, but they present the story of how Black children in segregated communities were essentially, by this definition, getting their self killed and their self worth and all that. And there is this group of lawyers and activists that step up to deal with that. So how do we deal within the precepts with this idea that we are witnessing killing around us in a huge variety of ways? And when and where is our time to both defend ourselves from being killed and defend others from being killed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, when do we do it? Well, first we have to see it's happening, right? And we have to see that, And then I think we are, I think the wonderful thing about this oneness is I think we have a natural ability to see what needs to be done. If we face it, if we don't run away from it. So we don't have to worry too much about when am I gonna know when to step in, or am I gonna, you know, I think that we, if we can become one with the situation by really watching it, we will know what to do. And we will maybe even have the strength to do some of it. I don't know, is that a cop-out? Is that like saying, oh, you don't really have to worry about this because you'll know what to do if you really, really, but it involves really, really not running away mentally from the situation.
I think that if I observe the society we live in, most people around me have lost that ability to understand.
Lost it or just covered it up?
Or
run away from facts so they don't see it.
Maybe they never had it, I don't know.
Yeah. I guess I believe that we have it. We all have it, but we don't. Mm-hmm. We push it away. Anyway, excellent. Brendan?
Yeah, and I just enjoyed your response, and I think a lot of it, that's the teaching of skillful means. You know, so there's no prescriptive rules for when you intervene and when you withdraw. It's about skillful means. It's about responding to the totality of the situation. Mm-hmm. And I imagine probably one step would be not to separate people into killers and those who are killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also was struck in your talk about how you were hinting at how the precepts can be phrased as kind of positive, in a positive language. So instead of not killing or non-killing, nurturing life,
mm-hmm.
or instead of non-stealing, practicing generosity. Like I like those kinds of, those make me feel sometimes like I have some agency mm-hmm. in working with the precepts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I always forget about the people on the screen.
Yeah. Well, first I was just going to thank you for that talk, but also I was going to say I was happen to be listening to the, I think it's called the Zen Studies podcast the other day, and the host was talking about self-acceptance and the need for self-acceptance, and that was her approach to this idea of killing, also including trying to get away from those parts of ourselves that we want to change or that we don't like. And in her definition, that was also, that fell within the precept of, or violated the precept of not killing.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
On the other hand, if that aspect of yourself that you're trying to change or get away from is doing harm to others, then it seems like it probably would be, maybe it gets down to skillful means, that would be a situation where you would want to kill that part of yourself that is causing harm, even if it's killing. So I'm going to exercise my skillful means.
It's a little dangerous to get into thinking of killing a part of yourself. It's more like we have to accept that part of ourselves.
Well, that was her argument.
Yeah, and nurture it and say, well, what does this part need for me to help feel a little better so I won't be doing these things.
Well, she was certainly arguing for that self-acceptance and accepting those parts of ourselves that maybe otherwise we'd want to change.
Yeah.
So I guess my main point was, I was just listening to something that was very similar to the point you were making in your Dharma talk.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, one of the things about the precepts too that's pretty interesting in this kind of practice of them that Mujo suggested, you really see it, is that any one precept contains all the other precepts, so it's just a convenient way to sort of attack. Or that sounds violent, but to enter into working on it through a particular thing. Well, thank you so much for hearing me out. Nobody got up and left. So I really love talking about this, and I love this book, and I mean, you talk about killing is only because I've only read about killing, it's like I haven't read about all the rest of the precepts, but I will.